So before we get started today, I want to welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals. We have only one case set for oral argument this morning. I understand that the lawyers have checked in and have broken up their time the way they want to. I wanted to take just a second and introduce the panel. To my left is Justice Brian Walker. To my right, Justice Dabney Basil, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. And for those of you who aren't familiar with how things work at the Court of Appeals, I just wanted to let you know that we don't hear any new evidence, we don't have witnesses, there aren't objections. This is an opportunity for the lawyers to make their legal arguments to us based on events that happened at the trial. So I understand also that the bailiff has let everybody know or reminded you that we don't allow recordings, photographs, and you're welcome to take notes. We do post the oral arguments audio usually about 24 hours after, so anybody's free to go listen to it again if you want to, but I'm sure everybody's got their cell phones off. So with that, I will ask the clerk to call the case. Thank you. You may proceed.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for the opportunity to argue this important case. I know you've read the briefs. You've probably read some of the record. You all are citizens of Tarrant County or the area. You know that this case, throughout its pendency, has received an extraordinary amount of publicity. I don't remember a time where I saw oral argument in a case make the front page of the Star Telegram above the fold. Part of our argument is based on that extensive publicity, and part of our argument is based on the fact that all of that publicity was generated, and the negative publicity, the inconsistent publicity was generated by a dangerous combination of individuals in Tarrant County, Texas, elected officials, high-ranking social officials, police officials, many people who all contributed to the narrative in this case that led to Aaron Dean's conviction.
But out of the 147 in the Vernier, 82 hadn't heard about this case.
Yes, sir, that's correct. They said they hadn't heard about it. As a trial lawyer, one of the things that greatly concerns me is the people that don't speak up when they're asked a question such as that. One of the things that having tried a number of high-profile cases in this county, one of the things I've come to understand is that, number one, people don't want to speak up when they're asked a direct question on voir dire. There's a very, very extreme reticence to do that. They don't like public speaking. They don't like being singled out. The other thing is that people don't want to be on a jury. And a good number of people think that saying they've heard something about the case is a good thing, that we're looking for people that have heard about the case. And they don't want to speak up for that reason. So the fact that a number of people said they never heard about the case is true, but looking behind the motives of those people, I'm very dubious as to whether or not that's an accurate number or not.
And that something matter for the trial court to resolve in its discretion?
That is something for the trial court to take into consideration. In fact, we presented some testimony about how we had a psychologist do a literature review, Dr. Janine Galusha, do a literature review. And Dr. Galusha came to court and testified during the pretrial hearings, the change of venue hearings, that people tend to forget that they have heard anything about a case until it comes to deliberation. And that information that they have in their heads often remains subconscious in their subconscious, but they still use it during their deliberations. They use fairly common psychological terms of confirmation bias and preconceived ideas.
But you're not raising any point that somehow your ability to voir dire was restricted in any way. You're just saying that perhaps people weren't being truthful.
Our ability to voir dire is restricted by the fact that a lot of people, according to Dr. Galush and according to the literature, retain this information in their subconscious. So when they're asked about it, do you know anything about this case? Have you heard anything about this case? Dr. Galush, her literature review revealed that they're truthful when they say that they don't, because it's in their subconscious. And they subconsciously act on it during deliberations. And it actually, because of the primacy effect, having heard that first, before they heard any of the facts of the case, they give that information a primary effect during their deliberations. And they use other things that they heard during trial to confirm what they heard during the pretrial publicity.
Well, let me switch gears for 1 second and ask you how you distinguish the Reiser case out of Houston.
The Reiser case has some similarities to this case, but it has some differences from this case. In the Reiser case, what they were complaining about was simply one news conference that was given by some of the elected officials, some of the city council people in Harris County. In this county, we had a couple of news conferences early on. Then the press picked up those themes from the news conferences, and it was added to along the way. Other people chimed in. So there wasn't just one news conference, as in the Reiser case. There was a lot more information here that was contributed by a lot more people than were contributed to in the Reiser case. That was small potatoes compared to the publicity we had in this case. And the Reiser case, for another reason, another point I want to make here today, is that change of venue cases should be reviewed under the 44.2A standard of constitutional harm rather than the 44.2B standard, because change of venue affects an individual's right to a fair trial and a right to a fair and impartial jury. So Reiser and many other cases that are cited in both briefs, the state's brief and our brief, on these issues, use an abuse of discretion standard for whatever reason. I don't know why. But taking it all the way back to the early 1900s, the Randall case is the basis for the use of the abuse of discretion standard to judge change of venue issues. But Randall doesn't explain why they use that standard. They just use it. And maybe it was because counsel in that case only objected on statutory grounds. The statute back then, Code of Criminal Procedure 578, was almost identical to the statute we're using today.
Well, even, so I want to be clear, even if we accept that argument, how does that alter the fact that the trial court heard from a number of people that they had not heard about this case versus balancing what your expert said? Seems like that creates a fact issue for the trial court.
Well, it changes the standard under which the case would be reviewed on appeal, certainly.
For harm, but for it harm. doesn't change what the standard by which we review the trial court's initial decision.
Well, we have to go back to the standard under 3103 that we're arguing today, that is the dangerous combination statute. It doesn't pin itself on the publicity in the case.
But isn't your argument under 31A, 31.03A2, really a repackaging of an argument under 31.03A1?
I don't think so. The elements are different. The elements are different.
I understand the elements are different, but the proof you're saying is that there was prejudicial publicity in this case.
Yes, sir. And it infected Mr. Dean's trial. And we know that from the number of people that said they heard something about the case. And we know that from the behavior of the individuals that were involved. We know that from the fact that some of these things were, some of this negative publicity was exploited by the state during the trial.
Has there been a case where a defendant has successfully appealed on the dangerous combination ground?
Cortez versus State, cited in the state's brief, and 69 Southwest 536. 1902 case, which has been around for quite a while, under the old 570 Code of Criminal Procedure 576, but the language is almost identical to what we have today. In Cortez, the court reasoned that the action of some influential citizens to take up a collection to assist in the arrest of Mr. Cortez along with the fact that some of the lawyers in town didn't want to defend him, amounted to a dangerous combination. And here we have almost the same thing. The citizens of Tarrant County didn't take up a collection, but a number of citizens, influential citizens, elected officials, et cetera, early on called for his arrest.
Well, what sort of weight, if any, in looking at the dangerous combination argument, you know, the Reiser case talked about how large Harris County was population-wise. Obviously, the state is saying Tarrant County is large enough that I guess whatever statements were made by public officials were probably attenuated by the fact that there was a very large pool of citizens to draw from.
And even that large pool of citizens, which isn't as large as the state wants it to be, because we have to look at not only the population of the county, but the number of eligible jurors in the county. A substantial number of those people had heard about the case. And a substantial number of those people were excused from service in the case because they had formed an opinion, a much higher number than I had ever seen in any of the high publicity cases that I had ever tried. And along the way, the other jurors who hadn't heard about the case were tainted by this, by the fact that the amount of time we spent discussing the publicity issue, they showed up for jury duty twice. Number one, to hear, to be screened about how much publicity they had heard, and then we recessed to allow to develop that issue. And then when we came back, we talked more about pretrial publicity. Anybody who hadn't heard about the case by that point knew this was a high publicity case and knew there were some community expectations involved, because they so much time was spent on it at Vore Dyer. So much attention was given to that. So that this dangerous combination consisted of many individuals from many different aspects of this community. And unlike Reiser, where the court went off on the fact that there was an initial news conference and then the publicity died down, I think the mayor testified at a change of venue hearing that there hadn't been anything about the case in the news for a while. In this case stayed in the news. There was something about this case in the news every week, if not every day, especially leading up to trial. And it continues to this day. And the publicity was thematic. There was a theme to all this publicity. There was a negative aspect to it because of some of the laws that were cited early on that didn't apply to this case, that were exploited by the state. One of those, the most important, being that a state official, a state senator, came out early on and said the law of the state of Texas is a police officer has to announce himself. Well, that's not true. It's certainly not true in this situation. Under Article 2201 of the Penal Code, an officer, a person is presumed to know that person is an officer by their distinctive uniform and badge. And the young boy who testified in this case saw a badge on the police officer outside their window. So there's no requirement for that. Yet that theme was picked up by the press and carried through. It's in this article I just cited to you a minute ago, the recent article. Dean, who is white, did not announce himself as a police officer. Those were the two themes of the publicity in this case that were carried through the trial date. So
you would say at trial, though, that, I mean, it's pretty uncontroversial. I believe even the state conceded in their brief that the evidence appears that he did announce himself. And the jurors who made it on the jury panel, who ultimately decided this case, knew that fact. Do you concede that, correct?
No, I think that the state exploited the fact at trial that there was no announcement by Mr. Dean that he was a police officer. He did not, before he fired the fatal shot, he did not say, "I am a Fort Worth police officer." His statement was, "I want to see your hands, show me your hands."
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Trying to build in a requirement that he announced himself is outside the law. And, you know, we asked for and were refused a charge at trial, a jury instruction, that a person is presumed to recognize someone being a police officer because of their distinctive uniform and badge. So we tried to counteract that, and we're unable to do so.
They did not dispute that he said to put your hands up, I believe.
Correct. Okay. That was on the body camera recording. Yeah. That was
that's correct.
You know, uncontroverted evidence of what he said and what he didn't say. It was all uncontroverted evidence. So the publicity it didn't die down like it did in the Reiser case. It continued. And it continued right up to the point of trial. During trial, Reiser went off on the fact that there was some is either Reiser or Cortez went off on the fact that they were discussed the fact that there were some threats and some fears of personal safety of the defendant. We had that same matter in this case with people threatening Aaron, people threatening his lawyers. We had a juror issue come up during trial. There's extra security everywhere, as there is here today. You know, there was pretrial publicity broadcast all over Tarrant County of Aaron being taunted and threatened outside the courtroom at one of his court appearances. There were a lot of moving parts in the pretrial publicity on this case, and it was all the result of what was said early on and throughout the case by this group of influential individuals. And all those are cited in the brief. And I have 7 seconds left, so I'm going to sit down.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Victoria Oblon, and I represent the state in this case. The trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying Mr. Dean's motion to change venue because Mr. Dean failed to meet his burden to show that a dangerous combination of influential people in Tarrant County combined to create an unfair environment for his trial. More specifically, Mr. Dean failed to show that any comments made by influential people or Fort Worth city leaders actually impacted the jury pool in Tarrant County. I want to begin by addressing the standard of review in this case. In Mr. Dean's brief, it's posited as a sufficiency, whether the evidence was sufficient for the trial court to grant the motion to change venue. But the issue for this court is whether the trial court abused its discretion in denying the motion to change venue. As Justice Basil pointed out, we don't get to 44.2 unless this court determines that the trial court abused its discretion. The Court of Criminal Appeals has held that this is the standard for the error analysis in Freeman versus State, which is cited in our brief, Dewberry versus State. The United States Supreme Court has held that a venue change is reviewed for an abuse of discretion in Skilling versus United States, 561 U.S. 358. And this is the standard abuse of discretion standard of review that this court is familiar with, whether the trial court's ruling was outside the zone of reasonable disagreement. And that is if it was without reference to any guiding rules or principles. Both in the trial court, in the state's brief, and hopefully today, I'd like to make clear to you that the case law on a motion to change venue is very clear, and the trial court acted within its discretion with the guiding case law on motion to change venue in reaching its decision in this case.
Do you agree with Mr. Gill that this case is different from Reiser in that there was one press conference there and publicity that had sort of fizzled out, unlike what Mr. Gill is representing happened in this particular situation?
The Reiser court notes that there was one press conference, but it also notes that there was additional statements made by influential individuals. I think they specifically reference a statement made by a state senator, but they do allude to the fact that there were additional statements outside of the press conference. So I think that there is more to it than just one singular press conference versus the comments that we have in this case. I would also disagree with the assertion that the attention on those The comments made by those individuals had not dissipated in this case. And again, this kind of goes to, Justice Basil, I think you pointed out, what the basis for the point on appeal is. Mr. Dean's point on appeal is based on 3103A2, that there was a dangerous combination. We pull in some of the pretrial media because the comments made by the influential individuals that Mr. Dean's relying on as those influential individuals were broadcasted to the media. So it is kind of this odd hybrid of the two standards. But when we're looking at the point of error on appeal, we must look at the impact of the statements of the elected officials and those that Mr. Dean has pointed out as influential individuals. And the state's not even really going to contest that the individuals referenced by Mr. Dean are influential in the Fort Worth community, perhaps some of them in the greater Tarrant County, but that they are influential individuals. But the media attention granted to those comments really did dissipate between the time that they were made in the immediate aftermath of the offense in October of 2019 and the time of trial and the change of venue hearing in November of 2022. I think even if you look in this Mr. Dean's brief, all of the comments that he is referring to occur between October of 2019 and the latest one referenced in Mr. Dean's brief is November of 2021, a full year prior to the motion to change venue trial. The pretrial media that existed in this case in the interim really just focused on the case proceedings that occurred. There were several settings in this case. There were motions to change, motions for continuous. There was a previous motion to change venue in May of 2022. The media covered the case proceedings, but I do disagree with the assertion that the media covered the specific statements that were alleged to encompass this, the influential individual or influential influence that's been alleged by Mr. Dean. I'd like to go back to a motion to change. The basis for a motion to change venue is to ensure that the defendant has a fair trial by an impartial jury. Whether it's based on the pretrial publicity under 3103A1 or 3103A2, the dangerous combination. So it's not just the fact that under the dangerous combination that influential people in our community spoke out about this case. The defendant has a burden, and this is from the Reiser case, that to show that those comments impacted the jury pool here in Tarrant County. And just simple calls for justice, which if you look at most of the, outside of the press conference that did speak to some specifics of the offense, most of the comments made by other influential individuals referenced by Mr. Dean are simple calls for justice and for the system to work and for justice to be for Ms. Jefferson's family and for herself. And in this case, there simply is no evidence to show that those comments impacted the jury pool here in Tarrant County. And I think there's two kind of categories that really show why that is. First, as I've kind of talked about, the attention on these comments and the influential individuals' words to the community truly had dissipated at the time of trial. And then secondly, with a county as large as Tarrant County, the actions of primarily Fort Worth leaders and officials did not impact the jury pool. So I'll kind of break these down. As far as the case law makes clear that the time between the complaint of media, which in this case is the reporting of the statements, and trial works against the defendant in a motion to change venue. In Cologne versus State, 573 Southwest 3D 249, the Court of Criminal Appeals noted that there was a significant amount of media attention. However, the coverage dropped prior to trial, and that was a two-year gap. In Skilling versus United States, which I spoke of previously, they noted that the decibel level of media attention diminished. In Shepard versus Maxwell, the United States Supreme Court noted that a continuance is a viable alternative to a change of venue, recognizing that the amount of time between when publicity or these statements were made and when trial actually occurs can make the media attention less so and less impactful on the jury and impact the jury less. That's 384 U.S. 333. In Ricer, the Houston court said that statements of the officials had been off the radar for many months, and that's just months, not years. In this case, we have years between when the statements were made and widely broadcasted to when the motion for change venue actually occurred. Also, in the interim between when this offense occurred and when the vast majority of those statements were made, we had COVID-19. We had a hotly contested presidential election and state elections, for that matter, as well as the aftermath of the 2020 election. While this case and maybe the statements from officials immediately saturated our local market, at the time of the offense, they were eclipsed by intervening events. And I think our responses during voir dire demonstrated that if you were not one of the individuals or maybe in the community that was affected by this specifically, it was unfortunately no longer on the radar. And that kind of leads into that there was no evidence that in a county as large as Tarrant County, that the actions and comments of the influential individuals cited by Mr. Dean and relied on by Mr. Dean in this dangerous combination point impacted the jury pool. As noted in Ricer, the defendant has the burden to show this impact on the jury, not just that comments were made or that they were publicized, but they actually impacted the jury pool in this case. And Ricer didn't make that up out of thin air. That was based on precedent dating back to 1915 in Myers, cited in the state's brief. The Court of Criminal Appeals noted that there was no evidence of the impact of jurors outside of the city of Fort Worth. That was a Tarrant County case, it was widely in the media in the city of Fort Worth, but the court noted there was nothing from how it impacted Arlington, Keller, Mansfield, and some other cities. Again, there was no evidence in this case of how the media that did report the comments by these influential individuals affected those outside of the immediate Fort Worth area. Likewise, in U.S. v. Ricardo, 619 F2D 1124, the Fifth Circuit noted that there's no evidence of how many in the jury pool viewed contested media. And similarly, in 2020, Tracy v. State, which is cited in the state's brief, the court said that there was no estimate of how many people actually received or read those articles. While there is some evidence regarding some circulation numbers of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and some of the local news channels, there's no evidence of how many individuals actually viewed this. Tarrant County is composed of 41 incorporated areas. The trial court in this case knows this. The trial judge in this case, he runs for election in Tarrant County. He holds trials in Tarrant County. He interacts with the jurors in our area on a weekly basis. He is familiar with the type of media that might impact them. In Skilling versus United States, the Supreme Court recognized this deference that is owed to the trial court. And I recognize we are in Tarrant County. All three of you reside in Tarrant County as well, but it is a little bit different down in the trial courts, interacting with the jurors, and Judge Gallagher's, like I said, running for election, recognizing these juries. So I do want to read this quote from Skilling. Primary reliance on judgment of the trial court makes especially good sense because the judge sits in the locale where the publicity is said to have its effect and may base its evaluation on its own perception and depth of the extent of the news. And that is what Judge Gallagher has the right to do as the trial judge under this abuse of discretion standard. Further, voir dire is the appropriate tool to judge the climate of the community. The Court of Criminal Appeals recognized that in Henley v. State, which is cited in the state's brief. The Fifth Circuit likewise recognized that in Pamplin v. Mason.
How do you respond to Mr. Gill's argumentation that there's these subconscious suppression of knowledge, that there's dishonesty sometimes in the potential jurors, that there's this gamesmanship that takes place where jurors will purposely say things in the affirmative, hoping that it will disqualify themselves. Mm-hmm. And then I guess on the converse, that sometimes jurors keep their mouth shut because they don't understand the process and they think that if they don't say anything, then they won't make it on the jury.
Yeah. I think that it is fully within the trial court's discretion to believe jurors' assurances and not cast doubt on jurors as dubious liars and to believe them at their face value. The trial court is there in the courtroom with them while they are making these assurances. The trial court is able to see, look in their eyes, see their body demeanor, just as we have with all other determinations by a trial court that is on the ground in the trial court, able to view them in response to the expert testimony regarding kind of the subconscious beliefs. That's evidence. And the trial court, as fact finder, is able to, and well within its discretion, to credit the jurors that it witnessed and that it heard from personally, and find that it believes those assurances over the testimony of the expert in this case, just as any other evidentiary ruling or factual-based ruling. This is a discretionary call, and the trial court was well within its discretion, particularly considering the sheer numbers of jurors that answered that they had no knowledge of this case. 43% of the jurors, after excuses were, joint excuses, we were left with 191 potential jurors in this case. 43% of them, 82, as Justice Basil pointed out, had no knowledge of this case. In reviewing for oral argument, I pulled numbers from other cases from the CCA, other courts of appeals, and that number far eclipses other cases in which the trial court was within its discretion to deny a motion to change venue with as little as 14% having no knowledge of the case, meaning 86% of a venire was in Freeman versus State, which is a court of criminal appeals case. 86% of the venire had been familiar with the case. They had heard about the case in some respect. And the trial court in that case was still within its discretion to deny the motion to change venue because there was nothing but speculation regarding the impact of, in that case, it was a pretrial media case, of the pretrial media on the jurors. And again, while this is a dangerous combination case, the vehicle by which the dangerous combination is alleged to have impacted these jurors is through the media. So I think that that case law is still relevant in this court's analysis of the impact of the juror on the jury. Similarly, in Gonzalez v. State, the Court of Criminal Appeals recognized that there was no evidence as to the extent that the publicity permeated the community and impacted the jury. In that case, 67% of their venire was familiar with the case, meaning 33% had no knowledge of the case. Again, that is a lower number that had of people who had no knowledge than what we have in this case. And I'd also like to point out Mr. Dean had the opportunity to voir dire specifically on the impact of statements made by these influential individuals. And I think during the individual, even on the individual voir dire on publicity, the focus was more on just general, whether they had seen news conferences. I believe in reviewing the record, reporter's record 21 is the individual voir dire of those who had heard of the case before. And I believe there's only one reference to the press conference that's been alleged in this case. There was one reference to Mayor Price with one separate jurors and additional one singular reference to former District Attorney Sharon Wilson. There was no other voir dire on the specific issue that is brought before this court on appeal, the impact of the influential individuals on this jury. There just simply was no evidence on it. Further, Mr. Dean, while he exhausted his peremptory challenges, he did not request any more on the basis of, you know, extensive publicity and whether influential individuals or not. And I do recognize the Court of Criminal Appeals has said, you know, ability to seat a jury is different than the motion to change venue. But when we're looking at such a large number of our veneer that had no knowledge of the case, I think that that is an important factor. In this case, I did, since I do have the time, I wanted to correct something in my brief. I noted in footnote 15 on page 42 that only three of the seated jurors in this case had heard of the case before. In reviewing the record, there was a jury shuffle and I got some numbers mixed up. There were actually five seated jurors. So just in candor to the court, I wanted to make you aware of that correction. In recent history, there have only been two cases that the Court of Criminal Appeals has reversed a trial court's decision to actually not even change venue, on a motion to change venue issue. That's Henley, and the error in that case was actually the error to in not affording the defendant a hearing, not even the actual merits of the issue. The only case in recent history that's dating back to the 60s of a trial court's decision to retain jurisdiction from the Court of Criminal Appeals is Rubenstein First State, 407 Southwest 2D 793. You may be familiar with that case as the Jack Ruby case, in which Jack Ruby shot Lee Harvey Oswald. This issue is within the sound discretion of the trial court. And the facts of this case, the evidence presented to the trial court in making its decision, particularly the answers given during voir dire, and the time that had elapsed between the alleged comments in this case by influential individuals and the actual trial that occurred, that pretty much 3-year time period between most of the comments in 2019 and when trial actually occurred in 2019, dissipated any impact by the comments of influential individuals, and therefore the trial court was well within its discretion based on the guiding rules and principles and case law of venue law to deny Mr. Dean's motion to change venue. For that reason, we ask the court to affirm the trial court's decision on this issue and the other points of error raised in Mr. Dean's brief. If there are no further questions, the state will yield the rest of its time.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
The comments made by the dangerous combination in this case were not simple calls for justice. The comments by the dangerous combination repeated in the press quickly turned this case into a racial matter. County commissioners commented that police let their fear of the black community override their training, override their duty to protect and serve. A Texas state representative said Texas and national leaders needed to come together to create strict hiring procedures for police that would weed out officers who have racial bias. A former state representative commented that moving the case out of Tarrant County on a change of venue would expose more white jurors to be on the jury.
Mr. Gill, let me ask a question real quick. You know, one thing that in the questioning earlier, you mentioned this idea about jurors being dishonest, them suppressing information, holding back answers and whatnot. And the whole purpose in is to make sure that a defendant gets a fair trial. That's what the trial judge has to weigh. And the idea is it possible that jurors, a good majority of jurors, truly would not know about these inflammatory, as you say, inflammatory or strenuous or sensational comments? You know, would you concede, you know, things are a little bit different today than they were 30, 40 years ago. The amount of information, the amount of noise, as some people like to call it, is much different. You know, 30, 40 years ago, you had 3 major TV stations, 3 major sources of televised news. Today, a lot of people don't even watch major broadcast news anymore. People don't have regular television. People stream. Everything's so much different. Don't you think that that factor is something that not only should trial judges consider, but also it brings credence to the notion that maybe, just maybe, there really are 80-something jurors who knew nothing about this case?
Well, and that's possible, but also what Dr. Galusha testified to during the pretrial hearings was that the literature shows that the jurors are truthful. They're being truthful when they say they don't know anything about the case because their knowledge is in their subconscious. And it comes out during deliberations in the form of taking precedent over what they actually hear during trial because of the concept of confirmation bias.
Are you saying that a trial judge cannot believe what a juror, a member of the Vannar, tells them on voir dire in response to a question?
I think that everybody that listens to a juror during voir dire needs to be skeptical of every answer they give, because they may or may not be truthful in their assertion that they don't know anything about the case.
That's a decision for the trial court to resolve, isn't it?
It is. It is. And it's something for the practitioners to try to resolve, but we can't completely resolve it because we don't know who those people are that are holding something back subconsciously or how much they're holding back subconsciously.
But it's the system we have. I mean, voir dire is an inevitable part of our jury system, and it's an essential part of our jury system.
It's the system we have.
And we're not mind readers, nor are trial judges. And so oftentimes we're left with, and trial judges are left with, what's been told to them, and doing the best possible job to judge the credibility of the person who makes that assertion.
And that's all we can do, is do the best job we can. But these things still creep over into trial. We can't, and in fact, there are a number of early cases that the state didn't cite to you that were cases were reversed on change of venue issues. And some of those cases cite some pretty interesting principles going along with what Dr. Galusha testified to. Randall versus State was reversed. Prejudice means prejudgment. Gallagher versus State. It was reversed on a publicity issue, as prejudice is often of a sinister character and remains undercover and is difficult to guard against, and it may be in this case that prejudice found its way into the jury box. There wasn't any proof in that case that prejudice found its way into the jury box. The court said it may be that prejudice found its way into the jury box. You can't guard against that kind of thing. Dr. Galusha testified that the emotional pretrial publicity is harder to forget than factual pretrial publicity.
Mr. Gill, didn't Judge Gallagher take the motion under advisement and hold his ruling until after voir dire was completed?
He did. But the first trial judge entered findings of fact and conclusions of law that the publicity in the case was pervasive and that the publicity in the case was prejudicial. Those two findings have been made in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Gill. Your time has expired. So your case is submitted. We really appreciate the oral arguments. It's been very helpful to us. And with that, the court will stand in recess.
All rise.